Nowadays, information technology is an essential part of any nation-state toolkit. And yet, in the digital space, nation-states are just a few of many actors. A mastery of cyber operations can give nation-states the advantage they need to pursue their economic, national security, or foreign policy goals. But without private sector and civil society cooperation, that mastery is difficult to achieve. Hosted by the Atlantic Council Cyber Statecraft Initiative, Season 1 of Digital Statecraft, Digital Statecraft features diverse perspectives from thinkers in academia, industry, and government. By bridging the worlds of statecraft and of streetcraft, it examines questions at the nexus of information and communication technologies, geopolitics, and national security, searching for cooperation to make cyberspace safer, more stable, and more secure for all. I'm Clara Jordan, the Director of Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council, and the host of today's conversation. Today's episode is underwritten by Raytheon, and my guests are Michael Daly, the CTO of Cybersecurity and Special Missions at Raytheon Company, and Christopher Porter, non-resident senior fellow at Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council and chief intelligence strategist at FireEye. So, you know, how do you see the contemporary geopolitics impacting the threats to critical infrastructure, Michael?
Well, the primary actors that you will see quoted by our government and other governments around the world follow with the current geopolitics, as you ask about. So it's the main actors are Russia and China and North Korea and Iran. These are the countries that are under stress by the international community to change certain behaviors, or they're under stress for reasons of employment. They're trying to, you know, make sure their people have employment, or they're trying to bring funds into their country. But in one way or another, they're under some international stress. And cyber is an easy way to bring money and information into your country and support your goals with the benefit of attribution problems. Well, you know, good luck proving it.
Yeah, I tend to think of it, it's funny, in the private sector, most people are focused on the technology aspect of the problem. So what's the latest technique and so forth? I think for most of the high-end actors, willpower is more of a limit than the technology. So these are techniques that have been available for certainly to the higher tier threat actors for a while now, and they just haven't done it as much. There are, of course, international agreements not to target critical infrastructure during peacetime. The big development to me is that there's a willingness to go after these targets, to go after explicitly civilian targets, to launch disruptive attacks, despite what, you know, 10 years ago, I think the assumption would have been that there would be major international condemnation of any of those incidents. And as more and more of those red lines have been pushed against by various state actors, there hasn't been a big pushback, a meaningful pushback. And so, you know, they push a little further and push a little further. The big change to me came when North Korea started conducting what are essentially criminal bank robberies or going after critical infrastructure. But once we started to see them going after what had been thought of as just criminal behavior, certainly there was international blowback for that. But I think that was really a turning point, that they were willing and able to do that and saw it as a success, as being good for their government, for example. So the calculations have changed a lot as well, that these used to be viewed as attacks that you would only do during wartime or maybe slightly less than war situations, and that there would be such international condemnation that no one would want to do them in peacetime. And every couple of months, we're seeing that assumption tested.
Yeah, and for the Russians, they're able to build out a foothold across Western society and hold us at risk. So it gives them a certain level of power. But it also brings them funding, and it helps to support their talent base. So they have these, you know, criminal organizations operating at will in Western society, putting implants out across every piece of critical infrastructure while bringing in funding and keeping their infrastructure up to date, their criminal infrastructure up to date, to be used against us during a time of war or some other crisis.
So it's interesting that you mentioned that they're keeping a foothold in the critical infrastructure, but we keep seeing and reporting the notion that our infrastructure is resilient. So why they're continuing to stay on the networks if the reports are saying that our infrastructure is resilient to the operations?
I would say that resilient and affected are two different things. You know, we will say that we can continue to operate despite the compromise, but that doesn't mean that they are not compromised in places.
Yeah, I think we're using critical infrastructure very broadly, but if you're talking about utilities, major utilities that civilians might rely upon, you know, the electric grid, for example, generically speaking, those are designed for resilience rather than for security. You want to make sure that the maintenance people can get in when they have to bring them back up when there's a snowstorm. And that's a more likely and more important scenario to you than keeping out an adversary. In the U.S., adversaries are mostly kept out by force of law and chain link fences. I mean, we're simplifying, but it's not designed to resist a military activity, for example. So generically speaking, yes, they are resilient systems. But to your point, if your goal as a foreign military is to deter U.S. action, for example, you don't have to know for a fact that you can bring the whole system down. These sort of cyber Pearl Harbor scenarios that are catastrophic, just the uncertainty over what would happen. I think because we're not really allowed to test bringing our own electric grid down just to see how our society copes, we don't practice that. No one really knows for sure exactly what that would look like. We have some experience judging from natural disasters, hurricanes, for example, but in general, it creates uncertainty in U.S. strategic decision-making, and I think that's the intended goal for most of the countries that are doing it, is to create a deterrent that this would be significant, it would affect the average citizen, and you can't really be for sure that your systems would be resilient. That said, I think for the major cities, the major parts of the grid, there's every reason to be optimistic that they would be resilient and quickly restore power. The smaller electric utilities in the heartland of the country, I think there's a much bigger question in my mind about how resilient they would be, particularly to a widespread attack that could cause cascading blackouts. But that's all the conjecture of someone who's not an electrical engineer. So take that with a grain of salt.
Hmm. Yeah, DARPA was actually recently able to run a series of tests against, you know, a mocked up grid. To see what the effect would be in our ability to remain resilient and recover and try out some new techniques for defending ourselves and techniques for remaining resilient. And as I understand it, it was actually a pretty good and successful event.
Yeah, I think for the major systems that we do have confidence that they would be resilient. What we don't have a lot of, though, is practicing it outside of a lab, right? So some countries do practice that, right? They bring the internet down for a while, or they bring emergency preparedness, sort of civil drills that the U.S. And its allies don't do.
So you mentioned about some of the things that our allies are doing. You know, what are some of the interesting things you've seen in your work, working with allies and different organizations across the globe, in the threats they are facing? How are they different from the threats in the United States? And then what are some of the interesting approaches they are taking to increase their resilience?
On our part, we're seeing an uptick in investment of defending those critical infrastructures. So they're putting in place monitoring systems for their electric power grid, for air traffic control systems, and other elements of the national critical infrastructure. And that's nice to see, and to see the investment finally taking place in areas that had previously been neglected. The other thing that we see that the U.S. is a little bit behind on is actually standing up an entire national cyber defense regime. In smaller countries, they can do that, and they don't have quite the division of labor that we have in our government, where we have title authorities, and we say, well, the military is allowed to do these things, and the intelligence community can do certain other things, and the law enforcement community has other controls. Because they aren't divided up quite that way, they can, at a lower cost, install infrastructure to monitor the internet and look for attacks against their critical infrastructure from a central location and put in place defenses. And so some other countries around the world are doing that.
The generic answer to that would be, I think, you know, it's interesting to see how different countries do information sharing, right? So that's the big gap in the United States, is how rapidly can you share information between the government, the private sector, and also between different levels of government, state and local governments, the municipalities. You know, you mentioned airports. I mean, in the U.S., airports could be owned by a municipality or they could be privately owned. But you still might assume, if you are in charge of managing defense for one of those, that if there were an attack by a foreign military, even a cyber attack, that your own military would defend you. but that's not necessarily a good assumption to have. Other countries have different social bargains between the government and the people. So not just small countries, but the UK, for example, has a much more robust link up, Canada as well, much more robust link up between national level government cyber defenders and the private sector, even when it does own those pieces of critical infrastructure. The US, the model is necessarily a little bit different because of our own laws and customs, but you can solve a lot of that through better information sharing. And the big gap that I see that I think other countries, particularly in continental Europe, have done, I wouldn't say better, but they've just started sooner because they have generally more centralized control. What you have to do to get down that path is actually get all the key stakeholders together and, you know, for example, run through exercises, you know, assume that an attack of a certain nature has happened and then say, well, who's responsible for this? Having run several of these myself, I can tell you in the US, the answer is often that everyone at the table assumes that someone else at the table was going to be responsible for it. So if they had never done the exercise, they would have learned in real time that, it was a very disjointed response effort. And I think our European allies have done maybe a little bit better job, either because they are small and can centralize everything, or they just have very different security relationships between the government and the people, like in the UK. They've gone through those exercises more often than the US has. We've done them in the US, in the finance sector, most notably, and in certain parts of critical infrastructure. But that's a big push that I think would improve things in the US and with our European allies, would be to do more of those kind of joint preparatory exercises where you've got government, private sector, all the key technical stakeholders, network defenders, have everyone there and then run through a few scenarios and make sure that everyone is following the same game plan. You don't want to learn during the middle of an attack that, you know, you were assuming somebody else was going to ride to the rescue and they're not coming, or they don't see the problem the same way.
Yeah, that's why I'm so excited about the launch of the National Risk Management Center under the Department of Homeland Security. They're following on the model of the financial sector with the FSARC, the Financial Systemic Analysis and Resiliency Center. And so with the National Risk Management Center, we'll actually be able to document all of the systemic risks that the different critical infrastructure sectors see for themselves and be able to better partner with the government so the government can actually help them, that there can be not just a response, but actually an outward-looking monitoring for adversarial actions that would indicate that adversary is trying to affect that sector or is planning to do something in the future. And that positions our government to be able to take preemptive action and prevent that attack from actually having a real impact on our sectors.
Michael, you mentioned the work that DHS is doing. I know you represent Raytheon on the NSTAC committee, and you are writing a report with some recommendation in the area of protection of critical infrastructure. Can you share a little bit about the work and some of the thinking that's going into some of the recommendations?
Sure. So I'm on a subcommittee, several of them, but one in particular is the Cybersecurity Moonshot subcommittee of the NSTAC. In that group, actually, tomorrow, we are bringing to the White House the report that details our recommendations for how we would conduct a cybersecurity moonshot if we do get approval to move forward and launch one as a country. And so we have recommendations in there to stand it up at a senior level, perhaps under Vice President Pence, that he would have, our advice would be, if it's approved by the NSTAC tomorrow, that it would have a director under it managing the overall framework of this moonshot. That would have a council helping it out, and that council would be made up of both public and private sector, much like, you know, the National Space Council. And they would be able to provide guidance on which grand challenges to launch under the moonshot. So there might be a grand challenge to advance a certain technology area of value, like, you know, rolling out 5G across our nation. It might be about software-defined networking or some other technology or quantum. And all of these could be individual grand challenges to help the larger goal. And there might be grand challenges that push on international policy or national policy or education. So there are six essential pillars of things that we think would be important to advance. And these grand challenges might cross over one or two or three of each of those. Collectively, over 10 years, the expectation is that as a country, although it would be difficult, we could actually come up with a new model for the way we operate the internet with better rules that would protect privacy better. Our data would be more in our own control, that we would have better control of our critical infrastructure use of the internet, which is now necessary, right? We have smart meters and we all conduct banking transactions. We would like to be able to conduct elections over the internet better than we're doing it today. So that's the goal, and hopefully it moves forward.
So we just had midterms elections and with lots of reporting on the threats, lots of diverse reporting on lots of different threats. So if you could address a little bit of what some of the threats that you've been seeing.
I think this election in terms of cyber threats was characterized by what we didn't see. We didn't see the same level of effort or direct threats that we saw in 2016. That's important to know. At the same time, it's a bit like, you know, the idea of boiling a frog, you know, does the temperature just slowly goes up and you don't realize that there's a threat? And what I mean by that is there still was plenty of malign information operations campaigns by all the major governments worldwide. So I think it has gone from being a specialized kind of activity to just another part of almost public diplomacy. And I think drawing which issues you're going to draw a line in the sand over is really important because we don't want to forever be playing whack-a-mole on what is essentially another country voicing their opinion, which we may not like, but that's different from being a destabilizing activity. And what we saw in this election was continued risks to the state level, you know, machinery that, not the actual voting equipment per se, but, you know, tabulation and voter registration systems. I think there's still a lot of concern. It's kind of back to our discussion earlier about threats to the electric grid. Everyone sort of feels like nothing happened. You don't have any particular knowledge of a major threat, but you also aren't sure that somebody couldn't do it if they wanted to. And I think a lot of that's going to come from investment, you know, driven by Congress to help the states run elections better on their own terms so that the states still control everything, but so that they have the resources and education they need to combat these threats. Because it could be information operations campaigns designed to influence people on social media. That has become, I think, normal and widespread for better and for worse. But it could also be, you know, tapping into criminal activity, which does frequently target voter registration databases, for example. Those are frequently pursued to enable fraud for criminal reasons. But obviously, nation states could tap that to manipulate election turnout as well. There's still a lot of concern around that. I'm actually seeing a lot of the investments are being made now that the elections are over. Suddenly there's a surge in interest in getting ready, I think, for 2020, which is appropriate. But we may have, you know, dodged a bullet for 2018 more through providence than good planning, I think.
So we've discussed a range of issues we're kind of collectively facing. And I'd like to hear your take on some of the solutions that you see available in the private sector and what are some of the recommendations at the policy and technical level?
The main thing I think that we're seeing advancing is this idea of segmentation and micro-segmentation. And it's not a new idea. We certainly had that concept around from the very beginning of having different functions on different networks and then having some sort of gateway sit in the middle. But what we're seeing is an advancement on two fronts. One, the level of network introspection is increasing. So not to get too technical about it, but, you know, we talk about, you know, layer 7 firewalls, but then going forward into what in the intelligence and defense community we call cross-domain solutions. We're going into very deep packet inspection and making sure that whatever data is flowing from one network to another actually fits the format and the content description that should be moving between those two networks. So that concept is advancing. We see it definitely in the financial front. We see it in the electrical power grid environment. And the other is on this micro-segmentation. It's an advancement that's coming more from the mobile device side of creating compartments within devices so that if I'm you know, let's say browsing the web, trying to do one function, it's completely contained and cannot affect other functions running on that device. And so we're seeing this micro-segmentation on both fronts, on the network side and on the deep device side. And that helps contain risk and limit the attack surface. And most importantly, perhaps, it gives you introspection. You can now actually detect a flaw if you put a gatekeeper, if you will, between those two environments. Hey, something is trying to move from one side to another side, and it shouldn't be. And so now you know something's going wrong.
Yeah, I think that sort of advice also makes sense in you know, unclassified but sensitive environments like critical infrastructure. Almost all of the major incidents, either outright disruptions or, you know, where the attacker got pretty close, all of them over the past year, dating back to the North Korean intrusion into the U.S. electric grid, you know, in October of last year, all of those have the same flavor of the adversaries trying to get onto IT systems, so like email systems, and somehow jump into, you know, the operational network, right? Which shouldn't really be possible in most environments, but oftentimes is. And so the generic advice, you know, that covers all situations for this would be, you know, check your assumptions. Are you putting into the operational environment a computer that is meant to control, you know, machinery? It could even be a factory. It doesn't have to be critical infrastructure. But are you putting something in there that, you know, has all the ports open, is able to connect to the whole internet, just like a desktop computer that you or I would use? But the person who uses that in an operational environment sort of just assumes that it only runs the machinery. So does your real-world assumption match up to how the device is configured, what permissions it has? Same thing on the network. Is it segmented properly? Is there any reason at all for it to be calling out to outside traffic? If you're at a workstation in a power plant, is there any work reason for you to ever receive an email from someone who doesn't work at the plant, for example? Many places there's, you know, they would have separate email accounts for handling, you know, HR tasks, for example. But on their actual workstation controlling equipment, they might receive messages internally, but it should only be from other technicians. So why would you ever have it configured to where it could receive anything else? But that's an extra step of checking your assumptions that you have to do. Make sure that the security level and the ability to communicate that you have and the traffic that's moving around matches what you would assume that you're doing. Because as I mentioned earlier, operational systems, particularly for critical infrastructure, they're built for resilience, not for security. They're built to, you know, generically allow people in or to have very few security permissions. They're just assuming that no one could ever physically get access to them or that they wouldn't. So that's a sort of a high level layman's technical kind of recommendation. Policy recommendation, I still am very concerned in the U.S. that we tend to choose different silos that the government says it will care about. Here's the official list of every sector that we, you know, theoretically would defend. A couple of concerns about that. First off, the targeting of individual companies or citizens or infrastructure that may be owned, for example, by a city or a state instead of by the federal government, you know, if you do that at scale, it can still cause disruptions to your society. It can undermine confidence in the government. Second concern would be that we haven't been great about picking those in advance. Election infrastructure is a good example. It's critical infrastructure now, but it wasn't before the 2016 election. So we're always fighting yesterday's war. I understand at a practical level, you sometimes have to choose what you're going to respond to and what you're not. But I think more flexibility and less thinking of it in terms of silos of industries we're going to defend would make sense internally for our country to do. Internationally, I would actually like to see a greater emphasis on the merits of diplomacy, notwithstanding, you know, the decision to raise trade disputes. You know, China did, maybe not 100%, but overwhelmingly comply with the Xi agreement. I think that's an excellent model for how you can reach bilateral agreements with adversary nations and work together peacefully, not necessarily relying on indictments and sanctions and things like that. I'm skeptical that, although those might be part of a broader strategy, I'm not, you know, trying to question the wisdom of individual incidents. But in general, I'm skeptical of the merits of doing that. I think it makes it harder later on to negotiate diplomatic agreements. I'm much more optimistic, I think, than others that correctly crafted, you know, with narrow but powerful norms that benefit both countries, the diplomatic agreements are a useful way to improve cybersecurity, particularly for average citizens, right? Militaries are always going to be going after each other, but you want to get some version of the society on society chaos that we have right now reined in. And I think peaceful diplomatic engagement is a better way of doing that than sometimes more adversarial techniques. But that's just my gut sense. The short plug for that would be that I think you can do attribution more reliably than a lot of people think. So it's worth at least exploring the diplomatic agreements. Sometimes people object to doing them because they think they're infeasible to enforce. And I don't think that that's true. But
and the other technology area that you hinted at in talking about monitoring your environment and looking for those policy violations, for actually validating that your assumptions about what data is supposed to move and not, is this move toward deep learning, machine learning, and sometimes people say artificial intelligence. But that technology advancement is critical because of the volume of data coming from all of the devices and sensors on the network. And as we segment them more and we add more Internet of Things devices and so on, that volume of data is going to balloon beyond any human's ability to manage it at all. In fact, it's well beyond it now. And so the idea of having smarter machine automated action is critically important to us getting this under control. I also agree wholeheartedly, by the way, with your thinking about we can't just say, hey, here are the lifeline services we care about. We have to start there, but until as a society we treat all cyber crime as a crime, we're going to continue to have problems. But as long as somebody can hack into your computer and you have no one to call except maybe a local store that you might have bought it from, or, some other private service, that type of crime is going to continue to balloon because it's going to continue to be valuable to the criminal. So we're able to accomplish that in parking. If you put your car in the wrong spot and you're there for 10 minutes too long, we as a society said, we're going to put a ticket on your car and you're going to pay a fine. When it comes to cybercrime, we don't do that. It's just ignored at the low and medium levels. It's not until it's a, quote, significant event that our government is right now structured to do something about it.
Yeah, there's an international angle to it, obviously, but it reminds me very much of the development of banking in the U.S., particularly, during westward expansion. You had the stereotype, of bank robbers going in and not only not caring if they were named as the robber, but actually, at least in the movies, going in and shooting up the place and telling everyone who their name was. And they didn't care, because as soon as they crossed the jurisdiction across the state lines, there was nobody to pursue them. The banks were responsible for their own security, and maybe it was a crime in the state they were in, and there would be a ranger or someone who could pursue them a certain distance. But it wasn't until, U.S. Marshals and later the FBI got involved and took it as an interstate issue, got the proper authorities to do it and took it as an interstate issue, that, bank robbery it didn't fall by the wayside. The bank robberies that occur are still bigger than ever. But overall, it stopped hindering the banking system. Individual citizens were no longer concerned because the government insured your money and there was, interstate law enforcement and so forth. It's not a perfect analogy because we've got different countries doing it to each other. But I think that general policy idea of at some point it was okay for individual banks to be responsible for protecting your money, both against failure and loss and also against theft. And nobody would permit that today. And we have a better system today. So I think cybersecurity, the end state of cybersecurity, will be the same way. There will still be large companies providing security, but it will be to bring you from that 95th to 99th percentile insecure. And the first big portion of it will be, enforced in part by, regulations and law enforcement and international action and diplomacy and government action.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Digital Statecraft, Digital Streetcraft. If you enjoy this podcast, join us again soon.